This is your co-host, Liv. Before we begin, I'd like to provide a brief trigger warning. This episode will cover topics including sexual assault, harassment, and racism. Listener discretion is advised.
And this is Therese. Welcome back to No History, No Self, a three-part podcast series dedicated to understanding the historic and current sexualization of Asian women, both in light of the violent hate crimes that have escalated against this demographic throughout this year, and in honor of AAPI Heritage Month. The name of our podcast comes from a loose interpretation of a quote by Jose Rizal, a Philippine revolutionary, who argues that we can't understand ourselves without first understanding our history. And we feel this is especially true when it comes to understanding the root of the violence that Asian women face today.
Through our podcast, we hope to not only provide a historical overview of violence against Asian women, we also want to provide personal stories and experiences surrounding this complex and layered issue. Today, in our final episode, we will focus on the stories of AAPI female-identifying individuals at Stanford. Therese and I were both extremely inspired after reading Chanel Miller's memoir, Know My Name, recounting her experience as a writer, illustrator, older sister, daughter, girlfriend, friend, comedian, and survivor of sexual assault. We actually had the chance to have Chanel join as a guest speaker in a class we're both taking, and her strength, joy, and talent encouraged us to seek out similar acts of courage and resilience in our own lives. You will hear both Therese and I talk to our friends and peers at Stanford as we discuss themes that were shared throughout these individuals' accounts. We want to extend so much gratitude to our friends who spoke with us and hope that all of you listening can find bits and pieces that resonate with you.
Liv and I are both seniors at Stanford, and because of that, we've spent many years observing the dating scene at this institution and the way it treats Asian women like us. There are two major problems that my Asian friends and I have encountered, particularly when it comes to heterosexual relationships on this campus, which is that guys are either not into Asian girls at all, or they're too into Asian girls. This has created an atmosphere of fear and skepticism as an Asian woman in the dating world. And even though I haven't spent much time experiencing this personally, it's definitely been a phenomenon that my Asian friends have talked about. We definitely find ourselves asking, will they not be into me because they're racist and don't think Asian women are attractive? Or will they only be into the idea of me because of their skewed perception of who they think I am and what fantasy they think I'll be able to fulfill? And it's honestly a really sucky feeling to have to wonder about these things until there's some kind of definitive proof otherwise that someone isn't racist or doesn't have yellow fever. Is this how it's been for you, Liv?
Yeah, so personally, I haven't spent much time in the dating scene. I've been somewhat of a serial monogamist, so, and the people I've dated have often been my friends first, so I've been really lucky to not question if their attraction to me was based on my race or ethnicity. But that being said, I've definitely had random strangers make really uncomfortable comments. I remember walking in Seattle earlier this year, and this one guy was saying hi, so, you know, just returning the greeting, as a decent human does. But then a few seconds later, he ran up and started following me and told me that I was the perfect size. I think he used the word fun-sized to describe me, probably referring to the fact that I'm a short, petite girl, and that was really unsettling to me. I think I often question how people perceive me when the overwhelming comments that I get are that I'm cute rather than pretty or beautiful and other descriptors, and it makes me wonder how people view me. You know, am I going to be taken seriously? Do they see me as a young woman or just cute? So I'm definitely hyper aware of those sorts of dynamics. And then of course, I've heard so many horror stories from my Asian friends who do deal with offhand comments, whether at frat parties or in class or even in professional settings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many layers to this between the experience I talked about with fetishization and then the way people view Asian women and whether or not we're taken seriously. And unfortunately, we're definitely not the only two people who have experienced and thought about these things. On this campus, dual fears of anti-Asian racism and yellow fever are pervasive in nearly every space Asian women on this campus enter. So we interviewed several of our friends, almost all of whom are seniors, about this issue and their own experiences with fetishization.
If you have, we were wondering if you could describe times that you have experienced fetishization as an Asian woman at Stanford.
My name is Gianna, I use she, her pronouns, and I'm Filipino and Chinese. When I think about fetishization, I think about a lot of things. I think about men I know on campus who say they have yellow fever with their whole chest. I think of men I've met at parties who told me they've always wanted to get with an Asian girl. I think of long-term partners I've had who've told me that they've heard and that they also believe that Asian women have tighter vaginas. And I think of the many Tinder messages I've gotten that are firstly asking about my race. I especially think of hierarchies between white men and Asian women that have always existed and show up in my life constantly. It honestly makes me wary of every potential romantic or sexual encounter I have with any white man. There was this one instance where I was seeing this person who was Spanish from Spain, and I'm Filipino, and once when we were in bed, he literally made a colonization joke, and I was so taken aback. I felt so unsafe, and it felt so violent to hear that I literally just didn't know how to respond. It felt like he was fetishizing colonialism, comfort woman. I just didn't even know what he was saying, but the fact that he brought it up and was acknowledging this violent history of colonization and hierarchies felt so deeply disgusting.
This experience is not unique to Gianna. Fetishization occurs everywhere, in places from classrooms to parties that have been made sites of fetishization, as you're about to hear from another friend of mine.
Hi, I'm Gianica Mendilio. My pronouns are she, her. I'm Filipina, and my major is Earth Systems. I know I feel uncomfortable being in just a party or even in my interpersonal relationships with other men who lean into the facts that I'm Asian. It's kind of devastating that it's still like that and that we are sexualized, fetishized on a personal level and also on a broader scale on campus.
Janica is also an organizer with Gabriela, a Filipino women's organization dedicated to supporting women within the diaspora and their liberation. So it's really difficult for me to hear that someone as intelligent and accomplished as her has to worry about the ways that fetishization has impacted her personal relationships. And once again, this experience is shared by many of our other friends as well.
Hi, my name is Jen, and I am a Vietnamese-American woman. The two types of experiences that come to mind are in romantic/sexual settings and also in professional settings, and I can give a story about both of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one time I was hanging out with a guy, and it was just really odd because we were still in the process of getting to know each other. So definitely, I don't know, friendly with each other, but I wasn't very comfortable with him yet. And as we were getting to know each other, he made different comments about you're on my bucket list for people to have sex with, basically, along with we also had an English professor who was also an Asian woman, and he had also noted that it's on my bucket list to have sex with a professor or a TA, and then he had pointed out this specific professor, and I was very uncomfortable and taken aback by that, mostly because of that student-professor relationship, but particularly because she was an Asian woman too.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt very very little in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I sort of navigated it was slowly just stopped talking to him because I didn't want to involve myself with people who like saw me as like a checkbox on a bucket list, as he had very blatantly said.
Yeah.
My name is Mayo. I'm a proud Chinese American woman. I am a first generation American, first generation college student, and the proud child of immigrant parents. As an Asian woman at Stanford, I would say that I have definitely experienced fetishization on this campus. I can name of more than one instance at a social event where I have heard groups of men say things on the lines of, oh, I've never been with an Asian girl before, or, oh, I hope to go home tonight with an Asian girl. I've also had people come up to me and say things like, oh, this person that you're talking to, oh, he only likes Asian girls.
These comments are just so devastating to hear, especially because of how casually the offenders seem to make these comments. Some of our other friends talked about how their mixed identities often led to unsettling comments about their Eurocentric features or racial ambiguity disguised as praise.
Yes, my name is Clara Bradley. I am half Korean and half white, but I'm very not white passing. You can tell I'm Asian. I rushed a Asian interest sorority, or they said multicultural, but everyone in it was Asian, on purpose, just because I grew up in a very like white neighborhood and didn't have a lot of powerful Asian women to look up to, actually none except for my mom. And when I rushed, all the girls were like, oh, like, this is like so great that you're mixed. And they were like, oh, like, it was like, I guess the mixed identity was more fetishized, and especially like the Korean girls were like really excited that they were having like a mixed Asian girl in the sorority, and then that was like looked up to. And then guys in general would say things like, oh, like, oh, she's like Asian mixed, like she's tight. Yeah. I've heard that before. Or like, it usually had to do with like being mixed with both. Mm. But I know a lot of white guys who would be like really into Asians, and they would be like, oh, like, what's wrong with that? Like, if I happen to like only Asian girls, like, why is that a problem? It's just my preference. Mm. Yeah, that came up a lot.
And when you say like mixed, do you find that usually people's like, whether it's within the Asian community or from outside, the desirability of being mixed, is that when it's Asian and white, or just Asian and really any other?
Asian and white for sure. Like, my grandmother, for example, was like really excited, I guess, that I would be mixed with white, because that the idea is that like you would retain like your Korean features, but you would also be westernized. And so you would get like my nose, for example, isn't as flat, or like my hair is lighter, or it's curlier or wavier. And so like it's like the at best of both worlds, like you still look Asian but you have more westernized features. And I think that's what a lot of like the Asian beauty industry is trying to embody. Like, they, you want like lighter skin, and like a nose and like more defined jaw, so like take Asian and then Photoshop it. So it's in both. And then I've heard a lot, like among my white friends in my high school, they'll always say things like, oh, like mixed kids are always beautiful, or things like that. Like, of course you're pretty, like you're mixed, and or like, I really want like mixed Asian babies are so cute, things like that.
Clara isn't the only person on this campus who's experienced fetishization as a mixed race person. Our friend Maya spoke to her experience with this trend as well.
My full name is Maya Rungaloo Caulfield. I am half white, Irish is what my dad would say, to be able to put his little spice into it. And then I'm half Indian on my mom's side. She's from southern India. So my name is, Maya is basically like the god of illusion in Hinduism. And so my mom had full reign over what actually me and all my siblings' first names were, power to her. And then my middle name is my mom's middle name, Rungalu. I actually don't know a lot about like the background of that name. It's just like an Indian name. And then I have my dad's last name. So even in my name, I've found a lot of like, there's a lot of like interest and just like story and like honestly just like contrast. Definitely like, growing up, it was a huge melting pot. So I think that is really indicative of like my name. But yeah, I'm half white, half Indian. Yeah, I think a lot of it went over my head at the beginning. I think like a lot of people have often said, I've really struggled with like the way I actually present to people. And I've struggled in knowing if I present like straight up as an Indian woman, if I present as somebody who's mixed race. And when I first came to Stanford, I remember in like my freshman dorm, there was like this, there was a big kind of, not like a big, but like there was a little bit of like a game of like guessing what I was. And like, I think in a lot of ways that impacted me a little bit negatively, like that I didn't even realize it at first. Like it would be the game of like all, it was actually all men being like, and now I realize that in hindsight, of being like, oh, like you're half Indian, half white. No way. Like I had on both sides of it, like people would be like, oh, let me guess what you are. Are you this? Are you this? Like it was as if I was like a form of entertainment. And I think in that there was a potentially a little bit of like flirting or like an attempt to like be funny.
Yeah.
I've dealt with a lot of like jokes in regards to that. But the fact that it was like a guessing game, and I literally had men only, I'm realizing actually as I say this, like forced me to pull out a photo of my family and be like, you don't have a white dad. There's no way you have a white dad. Or even on the other side of that, oh, you don't have a brown mom. Like you're definitely just a tan white person. Like I heard that from like people on both sides, which gave me just kind of a lot of like, a lot of confusion around how I was presenting to people. Yeah, and then it would just kind of like spiral into a lot of different things. Like even like a week ago, I was at brunch with a group of friends that I'm not very close to, but I was like there with one of my friends and it was all their friends. And we got into a conversation just about like who we thought we would marry potentially, or like who we, based on how we grew up. And I was talking about how I had like a multiracial upbringing and stuff. And at one point this guy flat out goes, yeah, I think mixed race people are the hottest, to my face. And I, and like I had this really uncomfortable moment where like he was saying this to my just straight up to my face.
Yeah,
my boyfriend was sitting next to me.
Oh my god.
And I just had to like sit there and like hear that and like take that and just like try to move on. And I was so uncomfortable because I just immediately felt so much like a sexual object or like a type.
Yeah.
And I think I hate the ways, like I love being brought up multiracial, but I also, and like being two things and trying to navigate that, like there's so much fun and joy in that and like a unique experience, but there's also a lot of confusion and like a lack of autonomy in how you actually present or what you feel like you can do. And I even remember like another story of like this period in my life, not specifically at Stanford, but when I was in Florence abroad. I was literally walking through the palace in Versailles. Like it was such a cool day, we got tickets to see Versailles. And I'm walking and this man, this man who's just like also visiting Versailles, like stares at me and just starts listing off places. He looks at me and he goes, Brazil. And I was like, what? And he was like, France. And then he just continued to like Egypt. Like he continued to like list off all of these different like nationalities or countries or places that he thought I was from. And then I like was confused looking at him. And then he was like, what are you? Where are you from? Like I was this like we're literally at a fucking museum. And like I was the specimen. Like it's just things like that where I think it's not overtly like, oh, my type is half brown, half white girls.
Yeah.
But like it comes about in like these really particular and unsettling ways at times.
And this issue of not being able to fill the mold of the constructed Asian beauty standard is not unique to just mixed race identities.
For me personally, I've also had multiple partners tell me that I don't fit the physical Asian norm, and it's been really hurtful to hear them generalize femme Asian individuals and sexualize us as this monolith. It all feeds into feeling like there is this ideal Asian woman, someone who is small, dainty, sweet, and docile. As someone who has never felt like I fit into that, it's always been a source of insecurity for me, and honestly still is.
Sometimes this fetishization extends off of campus grounds and bleeds into professional settings as well. Here's Jen talking about one of her experiences with this.
And then in my experience, like as a student interested in medicine, I've also done some like shadowing with doctors, and this was during my time in college, but not at a Stanford affiliated clinic or hospital. And so I was at a clinic shadowing a doctor and a patient who presented as a white male after his, and like also to give background, like I'm, when I'm shadowing, I like stand in the corner of the clinic and don't say anything because I'm not supposed to say anything.
Yeah.
And the doctor is a Muslim man as mm-hmm. well. And so this white male patient, after his visit in this like clinic room with me, him, and the doctor, mm-hmm. the patient turns to the doctor and is like, "How did you know I love the company of like small Asian women?" And I was like,
oh my God.
I mean, I was in a setting where like I'm the inferior professionally, where I kind of just like again stand there and don't say anything. Mm-hmm. But I was very, very thankful that the doctor like spoke up for me immediately, and he was like, "That's unprofessional, you cannot say that," and then like shuttle the patient out of the office because it was like the end of his like clinic time anyways, and then I think just talked to the receptionist to like schedule the next or I don't know what was next in his like treatment plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like taken aback this entire time because mm-hmm. I was under the assumption that there was a professional standard that like we're just here to talk about like patient care.
Yeah.
So it was like very off-putting that it was the patient who like brought up these like stereotypes and like mm-hmm. fetishization of like me standing in the corner. I haven't done anything this entire experience. I'm literally just standing there.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards the doctor did pull me aside too, which I was thankful for, and asked if I was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And was also like, "I know you can stand your ground, but like because like I have like responsibility mm-hmm. in that position, like I hope it was okay that I spoke up for you." So, I mean, I was really grateful that he did, and he didn't just, like, ignore it, because that would have made me feel even worse. But times like that remind me of when, and this is a non-Stanford experience, mm-hmm. when I was a cashier at a grocery store in high school, like, a minor at this time, and mm-hmm. It was a very white neighborhood, and, like, me just scanning groceries, people would make weird comments, like, "Oh my God, my wife is Thai too." And I'm like, "Well, that's cool. Like, okay. I don't know what to do with this information." It just reminded me of like me just trying to do my job and like
mm-hmm.
people bringing up like things that are unrelated.
Mm.
Yeah.
Next, we asked our friends how they navigated these sexist and racist situations.
Oftentimes, our friends mentioned feeling so belittled and disrespected that they couldn't respond in the moment or have let comments slide by.
I personally find situations and experiences like this at Stanford seldom talked about. And in those situations, I haven't really known how to navigate them. And to this day, I still don't really know how to navigate them. I've definitely talked to close friends about it, to other Asian American women on campus, and people who can relate and understand. But in many ways, I feel like I've kind of come to the same conclusion, which is that experiencing fetishization is kind of ingrained in the experience of existence for an Asian American woman.
At least the way that I was raised, I was not provided with any of these like confrontational tools. I think that toolkit is something that I've learned more in college, because I've had similar like volunteering in a medical setting experience where like an older person like made like very off-putting comments, and the way that I dealt with it in high school was just to like laugh it off. That was my first experience in like a professional workplace too, so I was like, "Oh, this is just like workplace banter." Mm. So I think I confused a lot of like fetishization
mm-hmm.
And like inappropriate comments as like, "Oh, this is what it's like in the professional world." So I wasn't, and I like didn't know really what to do to confront them. So like, yeah, I really just laughed it off and was like, "Oh, okay." And I was also like a minor and a minor at that time. So didn't know what to do. And then I think that if it did happen to me in like a professional setting again, like now I feel a lot more secure in setting professional boundaries at the very least. Like that's not even like calling out their inappropriate comments or stuff, but at the very least just being like, "That was not okay," and like, "This is a strictly professional place." But I think it would take a larger conversation to like explain to them why like their comments are not okay, but at the very least, like, now I like feel a lot more confident in setting professional boundaries and standards.
And so when you get these comments, you know, whether it's these guys who say these comments or from other girls, how do you usually respond or like navigate these situations?
At first, I just like feel kind of bad inside, or like a lot of the times it's like a positive thing, like with guys, or like it'll be disguised as a positive thing. Like I, like the last time I heard, oh, it was something to do with like being half Asian. Okay. It was a guy saying like, oh, half Asians are like wild. They're like, oh, they have the like the sweet side, but then the wild side. And I was like, oh, I kind of identified with that. Like, I kind of liked that I was not only seen as like super docile. I had like a different side. But then I felt kind of bad being categorized. I was like, oh, I feel good that I'm outside. I've categorized outside of a shell, but it's just like yet another box. Mm-hmm. Kind of like those Russian dolls things. Yeah, I got taken out of like one tiny Russian doll and like the next level up.
Yeah.
But how do I navigate it? I kind of just keep it to myself. Like I don't like conflict, so I don't really like challenge them, because they're not, it's very like microaggression-y. Like it's not like outright saying like a bad stereotype or like trying to put me down necessarily. It's just like, oh, kind of like I don't know, picking out traits and associating different qualities to them.
Yeah.
Clara really put into words the frustration that comes from being associated with traits and an identity that isn't your own. When she talked about being seen as docile, it reminds me of a conversation that Liv and I had with Chanel Miller. I'm paraphrasing here, but she described how the experience in the courtroom was always racialized for her and other Asian women. In Know My Name, she describes the moment she read her victim impact statement, where she was preceded by an Asian woman who detailed her experiences as a survivor of domestic violence. She says that the judge rushed the woman before her and seemed almost uninterested, forcing her to collapse her trauma into smaller pieces so he could move on to the next testimony. And Chanel talks about how after that, she felt like she had to cross lines off of her statement, which she did. She was forced to make space for others instead of being able to claim a moment that was rightfully hers. Where she noticed that Brock Turner's father didn't seem to feel that same urgency to shorten his statement and make room for others to have more time to speak. And that really gets to some of the implications of being perceived as docile, which Clara talked about. It's when other people, white men in particular, make the assumption that you will make room and space for others because these men believe that you are not entitled to take that space as an Asian woman.
But what's inspiring about Chanel is that through her book and her art, she's been able to take that space anyway, regardless of the voices telling her otherwise. Chanel even started doing stand-up comedy and allowing herself to be funny in the process of healing. You'll hear Maya talk about how she has used humor as a way to bring levity and empowerment to these situations.
I use a lot of humor to be able to navigate that sort of stuff. I definitely have friends that like I feel that I'm close with, that I've talked to about my identity, that like make like half Asian jokes all the time with me. And it's because like it's a playground that like I've started and like set as a precedent. And so I feel very comfortable in those jokes.
Yeah.
But I also have friends that like, well, friends, I just did air quotes. I realize this isn't filmed. That like will think that that is a ground in which they're allowed to be comfortable with me on, that I'm less comfortable with them doing so. And so I think like I've really tried to get very comfortable in being like asking them like, wait, what? Like making like, I think the biggest power in when someone says an insensitive joke is like forcing them to explain it, and then them having to like cycle into their own prejudices and like just their own faults in that moment or in those phrases, and like them having to deal with that. But yeah, I think humor is a way that I've navigated it. I have great friends who just take me for what I am, which I think is super, super helpful, as I don't even really often or always know. So I think having good people around, good support systems, but yeah, and also realizing that like, yeah, they, stepping into the shoes of who's saying what they're saying and why they would be saying it and their own issues that they must be probably navigating at that moment, or just it's trying to make them realize their wrongdoings, but also realizing it's not my fucking job.
Right.
And sometimes they can just look like a douche at brunch and I don't have to say anything, and I can literally just say, okay, well, love this pancake, like genuinely. And like them having to sit in that is kind of the best gift I can give myself.
Coping with these situations is so difficult, as Maya really eloquently describes here. When other people enact microaggressions and stereotype us, it places a large burden on us to educate them about the harm of their behavior, even when it isn't our job. And that results in a different kind of frustration that really has a lasting impact.
We were then curious on how formal academia's ability to educate us on our histories did or did not equip us to adequately identify and confront others when we experienced problematic microaggressions. Unfortunately, the overwhelming response was that our friends were not given any vocabulary or knowledge to know how to address these issues, and instead have relied on many moments of confusion and self-teaching over the years.
So for me, learning about different, you know, sexist, racist legislation that affects AAPI women, I only started learning about that in college, and not having that knowledge, I think, affected my ability to confront people when things were said in the past. And so I was just curious kind of what your education has been about your identity specifically, and how that's informed how you're able to feel comfortable and confident in these situations.
Yeah, I think a lot of my education wasn't formal, it wasn't academic. I think I lacked, like, there were big gaps in my education about just, like, American history in particular, the ways in which, like, Asian women specifically have been marginalized in this place.
Yeah.
And so a lot of it was, like family education about, like, maybe the history of India, or just, like, the ways in which, in my, like, circle, in my day-to-day life, it's, like, brown women dominate, and then I have a white father who sits and listens. And so I know that, like, I come from a bubble in which that is not the reality of the world, and so I think, like, I'm really grateful for that because it's made me outspoken about these things, but I also think because I didn't know a lot about, like, the history outside of, like, what happens in my family in a positive way, and maybe, like, some very preliminary, like, historical facts, I often didn't really know where I fit into the narrative, and I was like, I'm not really, like, marginalized because I'm also, like, half white, so I'm always like, is this even my story to tell, and like is this my battle to fight, or is me, like, like, what are the privileges that I hold in any of these scenarios, because like maybe because I am half white, like, I can be more of, like, potentially the beauty standard, or I'm like a whitewashed version of an Indian woman, and so then I'm like, oh, is that like me just playing into like the fetishization of like Indian women, but because I am whitewashed, I'm like this ideal version for like the man, or like for the white man in particular. And I think that's something I've really struggled with in myself, is like the ways in which like the space I take up, especially not knowing necessarily how I present, and presenting potentially differently in winter than like in summer, like who knows. I'm like, am I like, is this allowed, is this fair, because I really at the end of the day am inherently super privileged as well. It's like that's something I've navigated, and I so wish I had better education about all of these things. And it's something that, like, I think now I'm starting to, like, push myself to do more independently, but it also sucks that, like, formal institutions of academia have some shortcomings in that as well.
Literally not at all. I only found out through YouTube because I watched, like, the Fung Bros and, like, a bunch of other, like, YouTube, I don't know, channels, and they talked about like different types of Asian women and things like that. I literally didn't know anything about Asian history, and honestly, like, I think my dad has an Asian fetish, like I just, the way he like talks about Asian women and like the people that he's dated, and his brother has an Asian fetish too, and like my uncle has literally only dated Asian women. He's only he became an English teacher so that he could teach in Japan and Korea, like, ooh, super gross. And like my dad got divorced with my mom, or my mom divorced my dad, and since then he's like only dated Asian women, and it's just, you know, very icky. And even my grandparents would like fetishize like Asian women too, like my grandparents would talk about it and like talk about how like obedient my mom is, and like how submissive, and like she's the ideal daughter-in-law and things like that. And then my actually my grandmother, she's like, she collects dolls, which is really weird, but she really, her favorite ones were, like, all, like, the Asian dolls or whatever, and then it was kind of weird, you know? And then she would get me, like, all these Korean gifts. Like, I would get, like, the Korean pencil cases, like, the ones with, like, the stripes and, like, she would be the one to get me all those gifts. Like, my own, like, Korean grandmother wouldn't get me those gifts.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I think a large part of my situation, my experiences, and how I've navigated them is that I wasn't made aware of the history of Asian women in America growing up. I was never taught it in my history classes in school. It was not a class that was offered in high school, and it was not something that we really talked about at home. I come from a family of immigrants, and for immigrant families, the big thing was survival and doing what it takes to survive in a country that is so foreign and so new and goes against kind of everything that they're used to. And in order to survive, you have to assimilate and not engage with histories that go against this idea of American exceptionalism. And this was something that I never really understood until I took a class recently at Stanford within the Asian American Studies department, which helped me realize just how extensive the history was in America. And I'm almost ashamed that it took me this long to realize something that was so close to my personal identity.
With media being such a pertinent source of informal education, we wanted to probe deeper to see how representation of AAPI women in media has affected their sense of self. Most mentioned not being able to see themselves reflected in limited roles for Asian women.
And in terms of informal education, we also wanted to touch on how different media representation of Asian women affected the way you saw yourself growing up, if you did see yourself at all, and if there are any specific examples that were really impactful.
I think for me, I don't remember a lot of Asian women being in the media that I took in. Like some of the first examples that come to mind are like London Tipton from The Sweet Life of Zach and Cody. So that's one example. And then another example that I just thought of was like in Mean Girls, I remember that there's an Asian woman character. And I think she was like portrayed in a very like promiscuous light compared to like almost everybody else in the film who was like white. So it was, I mean, I think that movie has a lot of problems within it, but just that one instance I remember being just, like, not understanding why promiscuity was played such a huge role in her character.
And also, I didn't realize until more recently, right, like, the thing is that she is hooking up with the soccer coach or gym coach who's, like, this older white man.
Yeah.
It's, like, really,
Yeah.
The thing is, like, I felt like most media representation of Asian women was not Korean growing up. It was always like Chinese, like for example in Glee, like the two token Asian characters are both Chinese and they're like a couple and all of that, and I just never really felt super represented that way. Yeah, I didn't really see any, like, Korean figures growing up. And then on top of that, I never saw any, like, mixed. So I remember there was this one show called Teen Wolf. And the main character, I can't remember if I think the main character was actually Japanese. But, or, like, the character. She wasn't a main character. She was a love interest. But the actress was Korean. And so I was like, oh my gosh, like that was the first time probably in high school that I saw like a Korean woman on screen, and it was so cool. She was like a beauty queen and all of that. She's actually Nika Hika's ex-girlfriend. I was so excited, and I was like, she's so beautiful. Like she's the main love interest, and I was like, that's amazing. But I've not seen like a mixed Korean girl.
But it goes to show how media representation of Asian women when I was growing up and to this day is still not doing enough to affect the way that I grew up, as well as, you know, other young Asian women currently growing up. I think when I think about media representation, I think about
you know, shows and movies where there is an Asian actress that is a supporting character. And, you know, my reaction in those situations is like, oh my goodness, there's an Asian woman on the screen. And that's about it, right? Most of these characters are not fully developed, or they kind of play to stereotypes, whether implicitly and explicitly. Historically, and even in the present, a lot of the media representation of Asian women play to these stereotypes and ideas that are completely false and derogatory. And I'm thinking of things like the Dragon Lady and Tiger Mom and all of these really harmful things that I feel like I've internalized growing up. And I know my peers have definitely, because of how normalized it is to kind of just make jokes about stereotypes like this. And
yeah, for me, growing up, this question's also really interesting to me because I want to be an actor. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was like even more important, like not even more. I think representation matters for everyone, right. But I think especially seeing it not only as like seeing somebody that looks like me on TV, but also somebody like doing the career I want to do, mm-hmm. as like an actor, and there being such a lack,
yeah.
of Indian women in the first place, Asian American women on screen in general, that I think, mm-hmm. is slowly getting better. Still, like, there's such a huge need for growth in that area.
Yeah.
It was pretty discouraging, mm-hmm. And frustrating at times. I remember watched like Beckham when I was younger, and I think that was literally the first movie I ever saw with like an Indian female lead, and I was like, this is the best movie ever. I was like, I didn't fuck with soccer, like I didn't like soccer, I don't even know, but I just thought it was incredible because, uh-huh. I was like, oh, she's the lead, and like there's a family that's kind of like my family, uh-huh. on that screen.
Yeah.
And so I really loved that. And then like later on growing up, Hannah Simone, who plays Cece in New Girl.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
She, mm-hmm. was, like, the first... She was a sexually desirable brown woman. Like, she was hot. Like, that was her thing. Right, she was hot. She wasn't a doctor. She, mm-hmm. wasn't a scientist. Yeah. She wasn't a cab driver. Like, all of the stereotypes of, like, mm-hmm. what brown people are in America. She was a model. Yeah. And I was kind of, like, as somebody who wanted to be an actor, mm-hmm. I was, like, I kind of love that she can just be that.
Right.
And I also think, on the other side of that, though, it was, like, I found out later on, like, after researching her and, like, her career, she's half white and half Indian.
Yeah.
But in a lot of ways, like, she is super sexualized in her character. Like, she's, mm-hmm. the hot one.
Yeah.
And while that's great for the ways it's counter-stereotypical, it's also like, uh-oh.
Right.
Like, a big-boobed, half-white, half-Indian girl. Like, I know, yeah, like, you can't see me, I realize, maybe cut this out. But I'm like, oh, shit, like, is that just what I'm gonna be, like, narrowed, mm-hmm. into? Because that's now the path that's being paved for,
right.
multiracial brown women basically, mm-hmm. on TV right now. But also I love that character, and just her, she's able to be funny, and she is, mm-hmm. she is like a key member of that cast. So I think that was really impactful for me,
mm-hmm.
but I think in any character you can see both sides of it.
We've spent some time detailing some of the difficult experiences our friends have had navigating microaggressions and blatantly racist misogyny on this campus. But unlike stereotypes about us might suggest, Asian women are not complacent and docile in the face of these harms. All of these young women have found unique ways to reclaim their agency and to decenter the male gaze, whether through insisting on accountability for people's choice of words or by surrounding themselves with a support system of other empowered women.
Are there things that you consciously do to try to reject these stereotypes and reclaim your agency? I think I mentioned it earlier, but I think being in college just helped me grow a lot of my, like, self-confidence, and, like, yes. ability to speak up for myself and others better. Like, just being armed with better vocabulary to, mm-hmm. stand up for myself.
Yeah.
So I think I've been just, like, the way that I, like, stand up to these stereotypes is, again, like, setting up very professional boundaries. And sometimes I feel like I have to, like, overcorrect the stereotypes by, like, being extra professional up front, mm. because I don't want people to take me the wrong way or think that I'm submissive and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I feel like generally I, like, put on a front of being extra professional so that people, mm. like, I'd rather, yeah. be extra professional than,
right.
think that I'm, like, not a leader or that, uh-huh. like, I'm incapable of something.
Mm.
But, yeah, I feel like I'm, like, especially in professional settings, like, always overcorrecting.
There's a lot that I do try to do to reject these stereotypes and reclaim agency, but it's really hard when media continues to kind of play to these misrepresentations of Asian women. I think growing up, one way I tried to reject stereotypes And I'm ashamed to say that I kind of did this through high school, was kind of assimilate and kind of whitewash myself in a way, right? I no longer wanted to be tied to my Asian roots because they were associated with these stereotypes. And I found that, you know, if you whitewashed yourself, if you acted a certain way, if you spoke a certain way, and if you thought certain things, like, people would accept you and you wouldn't experience some of these things that are so negative.
And then, you know, maybe it's in the roles that you take on or different things, but are there ways that you consciously try to reject stereotypes about brown women and reclaim your agency in that way?
Yeah, I think, especially as an actor, it's been really interesting. And I've been super lucky to have, like, mentors and directors who have given me opportunities and roles that I think are traditionally or would traditionally be, like, white roles, I guess. Mm. And, like, I think them allowing me to take up spaces and slowly, like, make theater or even film, like, a little less white is, like, a huge privilege that I've had. And I'm so grateful for that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something that I've really enjoyed, is the ways in which, like, casting in particular can be, like, can be color conscious, not colorblind, because I think that that's inherently extremely problematic.
Yeah.
But there is a way in which to complicate and, like, make these traditional narratives a lot more interesting and a lot more exciting, in my opinion, because I'm sorry, I've watched two white people fall in love way too many times for, like, my tastes on Netflix or on the stage or anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I also think just, like, I talked about this before, but, like, trying to use humor to, like, engage in these conversations and make people feel more comfortable to be like, whoa, that's problematic, or, oh, whoa, she talks back, like, maybe I shouldn't have said that shit, like, she was just, like, a statue in Versailles. But yeah, I think those have been really helpful things for me.
Cool.
When frustrating things like this happen, one thing that Liv, our interviewees, and I have found is that spending time in the company of other women can be a true source of healing and empowerment.
So in situations like that, it really doesn't feel like there are many ways to reclaim my agency, just because I feel so belittled, so small. But ways that I try to do that outside of those situations and in my daily life are being loud about celebrating the diverse beauty of femme Asian people and decentering the male gaze, especially the white male gaze, in the way that I think about myself and my worth. I'm also so grateful to be surrounded by others who do the same and constantly inspire me and make me feel loved.
I think that I'm still working on that, especially, like, confronting people or talking to people about, like, the comments they make and the way they make me feel, especially with men. I feel like it's really hard for me to speak up against it. But I think my main thing has been hanging out with and looking up to other Asian women who I feel like are more powerful than me. For example, like, hanging out with you really empowers me.
Mm-hmm.
And just learning from other Asian women and, like, surrounding myself with other Asian women who experience the same things as me and are able to articulate it so much better than me.
Mm-hmm.
So that has helped me a lot and has helped make me become a better person in terms of reclaiming that, because normally I would just kind of, like, dismiss it or, like, push it aside, repress it, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's always so inspiring to hear stories like this, where Asian women my age are defending themselves against microaggressions and fetishization, no matter how difficult. But we also want to highlight how these experiences make up only a sliver of these women's identities. They have lives that are rich and beautiful outside of the men whose words attempt to diminish their joy. Here they are again, sharing their future aspirations, which we can't wait to see become a reality.
And then to finish off, we want our listeners to have a representation of what real AAPI women are doing and what they have to offer. So if you can just talk a little bit about your career aspirations and who you are and the ways you want to be seen as.
Oh, yes. So I aspire to work in the field of community health and community education. Right now I see myself as being some sort of maybe pediatric doctor, and I'm really interested in ophthalmology or eye care, because I think vision plays a really cool role in both health and learning outcomes. So I love working with Vietnamese families, particularly Vietnamese kids. And I've gotten the chance to work with Vietnamese people at like the clinic that I volunteer at. So that's been very exciting. And I hope that people still see me as like very friendly and capable, but also as like a strong leader. Mm-hmm. And I think something I'm still working on is like how to set professional boundaries, but still like let my like personality shine through. Because again, like I feel like a lot of times I like go above and beyond to be extra professional to make sure that I'm taken seriously. But mm-hmm. I like still want people to see me as like, I don't know, the everyday like fun person that I am, like even in professional settings mm-hmm. when it is appropriate. But yeah.
Cool. Okay. Thank you so much, Jess.
Thank you.
Right now, I study product design and computer science, but in the future, I hope to put my education towards inclusion, justice, and community care.
I aspire to be a practicing physician for underserved communities and help and uplift those in the same way that so many have done for me.
Career aspirations wise, I talked a lot about like not really seeing representations of myself and a lot of my friends that are women of color not seeing representations of themselves in film and TV. And so like a big goal of mine mm-hmm. is to, in life, I guess, is really just to like diversify Hollywood. Right after I graduate here, I'm moving to LA. I'm kind of doing the audition circle of just like trying to make it as an actor, dun-dun-dun. Mm-hmm. But also I've taken a lot of screenwriting courses here, and I think like the biggest gift that somebody can give and the way in which you have the most autonomy as a creator, specifically in the entertainment industry, is to write the roles that you don't see or that you aren't auditioning for. Mm-hmm. So there's an importance in like visibility and being seen. And so I think with auditioning and stuff, that's like what I'm shooting for, but also writing roles that otherwise that like the white men in writers' rooms are not writing. Yeah. And even if it's like kind of honestly like a bad web series to start, mm-hmm. but just like creating those images and those portrayals of women and BIPOC women is really important. And so like that's my big goal, because I think outside of I did a lot of theater growing up, but I think film and TV has a particular strength in reaching a broad range of audiences that otherwise it would not, because theater caters to the privileged time and time again. Mm-hmm. And I think film and TV is often people's only exposure to different communities.
Yeah.
And I think there's a great burden and a weight on those representations to be complicated and accurate and mm-hmm. beautiful and believable and like everything that those people truly are,
yeah.
Not just caricatures. And so, yeah, and who I am, who I want to be, gosh, I think I consider myself like a pretty positive, outgoing person. Just want to make people laugh, spread a little bit of joy, have fun while we're here. And also just like, I'm just like very grateful. I know that like my experience on this earth is inherently very privileged, and I'm so lucky to like be in an institution like this one and like be able to be, to say, oh, I'm moving to LA and I'm following my dreams. And so yeah. I just want to like sit in like the gratitude of that mm-hmm. and allow like the people that got me here to know my gratitude for them, and just like to be able to move forward in a positive way, but also just like bring the good people with me regardless mm-hmm. of what shape that takes. Mm-hmm. I think like community is such a huge part of how I'm here today, and like the reason I see such positive things in this world even when times are tough.
I'm going to be a product designer for a startup here in the Bay, and my dreams career-wise is to own my own bakery and then maybe another business.
Wow, that was just so incredibly inspiring to hear. These women have already changed the world we live in so, so many ways, and I can only imagine the impact they'll have in the future. And it's exciting knowing that we have a future bakery to visit, future doctors we can trust, future actress we can watch and refer on screen, and so, so much more. Hearing them share their passions and goals reminds me of how much beauty exists in the lives of Asian women outside of the tragedies and harms that attempt to define us.
Absolutely, and I think this is a wonderful way to conclude our 3-part series of No History, No Self. Thank you so much for listening to us speak and ask questions that allowed us to probe into our own identities. And a special thank you to Clara Bradley, Maya Caulfield, Gianna So, Jennifer Vu, Jenica Mendilio, and Mayo Gong for joining us in this special episode.
In this podcast, we've covered a lot of ground, So to recap, we began by analyzing the impact of legislation like the Page Act, Expatriation Act of 1907, and the War Brides Act of 1945 with the incredible Grace Poon Ghaffari. Through our analysis, we were able to understand how policies like these, which seem like a thing of the past, have largely impacted notions of who Asian women are in the modern American landscape. Policies like these, and the ones we see created today, create and reinforce concepts of race and gender, and the implications of these things cannot be undermined, as we saw with that tragic Atlanta shooting.
In our second episode, we had the honor of speaking with Dr. William Gao about the different ways AAPI women have been or not been represented, and how to move conversations about representation beyond the binary of good or bad, instead focusing on acts of resistance within these existing pieces. And in our episode today, you listen to us discuss how young Asian American women grapple with the contextualization of their identities among male-dominated spaces.
There's a lot of pain in the histories and personal experiences we've discussed. It is awful to not only revisit racist, misogynistic policies and media misrepresentations, but also experience these things in our daily lives and watch our friends grow through experiences of fetishization and hypersexualization themselves. But we refuse to allow microaggressions, stereotypes, and the legacies of harmful cultural models to define us and our experiences. At the end of the day, our legacy as Asian women is not one of violence, it is one of resilience. It is one of strength, and it is one of joy. And though the resilience of Asian women has often been forced upon us by the harms of white supremacy, it is resilience worth celebrating nonetheless. At the end of our interview with Grace in our first episode, we asked her and ourselves an important question. How is it that violence against Asian women has been normalized and condoned for so long? And how do we begin to end this insidious cycle? We hope that the context we provided in these episodes has helped you begin to answer both of these questions. After all, knowing history and refusing to enact its mistakes is the only way forward.
Although we are very aware of the limited scope of experiences that we could cover, our wish is that you were able to collect small nuggets of comfort, insight, and warmth through this journey. We are both so inspired by all of those who have paved the way for women like us, and by our peers who act as trailblazers for the future. If you have any questions or want to leave us any comments, please feel free to contact either Teresa or I via knowhistorypod@gmail.com. That's spelled K-N-O-W, history, P-O-D, @gmail.com.
I want to end with a quote from Aro Kwan, an author who wrote a stunning piece in response to Atlanta that we'll link in the description below. She says, "I was talking with a close friend, the writer Ingrid Rojas Contreras, about some of the complications of our lives as women of color, and she said, in a moment that felt like a cloud breaking, like clarity, 'We matter to me. You matter to me. We matter to me. And I would so much rather have us and our allies on our side than any of them, for we already belong.'"
As always, please remember to be kind to yourselves and find pockets of happiness in your days. We are sending so much love and warmth to all of you listening. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.